This podcast has been generously co-sponsored by Adina and Simon Brief in memory of Adina's father, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Neustein, Harav Yehuda ben Yecheskel, who lived a life of Torah and Derech Eretz to the fullest. It is also co-sponsored by Eli Elias in memory of his beloved grandfather, Eli.
Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Beau. This week, Rabbi Michael Hatton discusses Beau. Rabbi Michael Hatton is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Michael Hatton.
As Parshat Beau opens, the plague of locusts descends upon Egypt. Pharaoh's ministers watch with a combination of astonishment and dread, as the sonorous swarms hungrily consume any green vestiges still left in the fields after the awesome plague of hail. The God-King himself, with crumbling resolve but paralyzed will, looks on fearfully, but is unable to bring himself to release the Hebrew slaves. The plague of darkness then quickly follows, plunging the land of Egypt into a palpable gloom that foreshadows the dark death about to be unleashed against her firstborn sons. But with rekindled defiance, Pharaoh banishes Moshe and Aharon from his presence and deafens himself to their last demands. Before taking his final leave, Moshe announces to Pharaoh the inevitable consequence of his vile obduracy. His own beloved son, the future bearer of the fabled double crown, will prematurely perish, along with all of Egypt's eldest, but Israel will not be harmed. Abruptly, the Torah redirects our attention to the preparations of the people in anticipation of their freedom. Buoyed by the announcement of their imminent liberation and flushed with the promise of springtime, the people of Israel are commanded to regard the month of the Exodus as their first of months. From now on, their seasons of national celebration will be counted from that moment, and the years of their history and their sacred commemorations will be marked by that exit. Having so designated the first of months, God commands the people to take unblemished one-year-old male lambs on the 10th day to serve as the paschal sacrifice, the Korban Pesach. Each household is to gather together as a group to partake of the sacrifice, which is to be slaughtered on the 14th day of the month in the afternoon. Shmot chapter 12 relates, "They shall take from the blood and place it upon the doorposts and the lintels of the homes in which they shall eat it. They shall eat the flesh on this night roasted over fire and accompanied by matzot and bitter herbs. Do not consume it raw or cooked in water, but rather roasted over fire, whole, with its head, limbs, and innards. Do not leave over from it until morning, and burn with fire any that remains until daybreak. Thus shall you eat it, with your loins girded, your shoes upon your feet, and your staff in your hands. Eat it in haste, for it is Pesach to God. I shall pass through the land of Egypt on this night, and I shall strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, whether of man or of beast, and I shall execute judgment against all of the gods of Egypt. I am God. The blood shall be your sign upon the houses in which you gather. I shall see the blood and pass over you, ufasachti, and the plague shall not destroy among you when I strike the land of Egypt. This day shall therefore be remembered by you, and you shall celebrate it as a festival to God. For all of your generations, you shall celebrate it as an eternal commemoration." In this way, the rather specific injunctions relating to the paschal sacrifice are spelled out. Many of the unique features of the rite are readily comprehensible. Gathered as close-knit and cohesive units, the former individuals of Israel, now finally coalescing into a nation, are to partake of its meat in a state of impatient anticipation of the dawn of liberation. They are to be dressed and ready to leave Egypt at a moment's notice, demonstrating steadfast trust in God's promise, even while the destroying angel performs his gruesome work. Similarly, the lamb is to be roasted whole, eaten with quickly baked unleavened bread, and seasoned with nothing more elaborate than bitter herbs, to emphasize the hurriedness of the meal. There is to be no time expended in the preparation of anything more time-consuming, for God's redemption will unfold in the blink of an eye, and Israel must be ready to set forth. Of course, the ceremonial features are multidimensional. The matzot recall as well the poor man's bread consumed in bondage, and the bitter herbs evoke the harsh servitude and the sting of the taskmaster's whip. Of all of the sacrifices' unusual characteristics, however, it is the blood service that appears most inexplicable. Significantly, it is the placement of the blood upon the doorposts and lintels that conditions God's merciful passing over. But the text does not at all spell out the meaning of this sign. Why should the portal be so stained at all? Why with the blood of the sacrifice, and not with some other chromatic marker? To obfuscate matters further, why is it that only the first Passover in Egypt incorporated this ceremony? The Ramban explains, the prohibition of consuming the lamb while it is raw is for all subsequent generations, because all of the commands that pertain to the actual body of the sacrifice are eternal. But the extrinsic injunctions relating to those that consume it, such as the necessity for loins girded and shod feet, the placement of the blood upon the portal, these apply only to that first Pesach of Egypt. As the Ramban explains, all of the procedures that relate to the preparation and consumption of the Pesach sacrifice's actual flesh are understood to be eternal commands of the Torah, to be executed whenever the Passover ritual is observed. But all of the additional features that frame the ceremony and form such a prominent part of that first celebration in Egypt are understood to be unique observances to that time and place, and are not to be incorporated as part of the Passover's eternal implementation. How to explain the notorious placement of the blood? In order to provide a plausible explanation, let us begin by noting some of the other features of that special meal. Firstly, as we noted earlier, the Paschal lamb was consumed by household units that consisted of nuclear families, close relations, and invited guests. In the Talmudic formulation, the sacrifice may only be consumed by those who have been appointed ahead of time to partake. Secondly, these cohesive groups gathered in their huts and effectively shut themselves in, for none were to leave the secure embrace of kin and the protective heat of the hearth until the daybreak. With doorposts and lintels smeared with blood, the people of Israel were to remain safely indoors beyond the reach of the destroying angel, for none of you shall trespass beyond the opening of your homes until the morning. Thirdly, as the Israelites serenely partook of their meal of redemption, the silent night was repeatedly punctuated by the muffled screams of the Egyptians, and even the fitful sleep of Pharaoh himself was interrupted at the stroke of midnight. Pharaoh arose at night, he and his ministers in all of Egypt, for there was a great outcry all over the land. There was not a household among them that did not experience a death. Shmot chapter 12, verse 30. Taken together, the three above elements clearly evoke a sense of protection and sealed insularity against the irrepressible shrieks that otherwise shatter the dark stillness. Israel is safe and secure within, while without, chaos and confusion reign. As dawn breaks, the screams subside. The bolted doors are flung open, and the people of Israel step into the blinding light of freedom. The symbolism of the experience is crystal clear. On that night of terror, a nation is being born, and on the morrow they are brought forth. The threshold, consisting of doorposts and lintel stained with blood, defines the decisive moment in time and space that separates the protection and stillness of the womb from the harsh cries of daylight. To cross that verge, to pass through that painful portal, is to experience that most excruciating and exhilarating of all experiences, birth. The boldness of the metaphor also explains its singularity. The Exodus may be an eternal commemoration of emancipation from tyranny, the Passover sacrifice, a perpetual observance of God's saving intervention, but the particular features that address the theme of birth must remain unparalleled. A person and a nation is born but once, and once crossed, the threshold of delivery cannot be retraced or crossed again. Remarkably, this very theme of birth finds expression in an astonishing vision communicated by God to the prophet Yechezkel, who addressed the exiled Judeans by the rivers of Babylon some 800 years after the Exodus from Egypt. Recalling the abject state in which God found their oppressed ancestors in Egypt, the prophet describes in coarse terms that recall the disarray and inelegance of birth, God's compassionate involvement. The word of God came to me, saying, "Son of man, inform Jerusalem. On the day that you were born, your umbilicus was not cut, nor were you washed clean with water, conditioned with salt, or swaddled in diapers. No one had compassion upon you to perform even one of these things to show kindness. For you were instead cast out into the field in your repulsive state on the day that you were born. I passed upon you, and I saw you wallowing in your blood, and I called to you, 'By your blood you shall live. By your blood you shall live.'" Yechezkel chapter 16, verses 1 through 6. In context, the harsh words of the prophet are a stinging rebuke to his compatriots, the people of Israel, who forgot their humble origins and the God that sustained them from the beginning. Like an abandoned newborn, they had been forsaken under Egyptian bondage, covered with the mire of clay and mortar, and utterly bereft of any human kindness, until God passed over them and raised their spirits with his fortifying words. Notwithstanding their cruel and anguished predicament, they would endure, for their dreadful crimson coating would be transformed into the sanguine smudge of survival. The prophet clearly alludes to the experience of the Exodus as the process of the nation of Israel being born. While he sees in hindsight their terrible subsequent treachery, we see in foresight their moment of great promise. They are indeed like a newborn child. It is therefore perfectly plausible that the symbolism of that transcendent moment be marked upon the threshold of their shelters by the most familiar marker of birth, blood. Significantly, the rabbis read the passage in Yechezkel in a similar light. In the Midrash Mechilta, Parshat Bo, chapter 5, the paschal sacrifice and the blood service are described. You shall guard the lamb until the 14th day of this month. Why did the Torah ordain the taking of the lamb 4 days before its slaughter? Rabbi Matya ben Cheresh explained, the time had arrived for God to fulfill his oath to Avraham to redeem his children. But they had no mitzvot to perform in order to merit redemption. Therefore, God gave them the twin mitzvot of the blood of the paschal lamb and the blood of circumcision in order that they might merit redemption. As the verse states, I passed upon you and saw you wallowing in your blood, and I called to you, by your blood you shall live. By your blood you shall live. They were therefore commanded to separate the lamb 4 days beforehand to indicate that one can receive reward only for acts. This Midrashic source emphasizes that the redemption of the people was a function of the merits that they had secured by hearkening to God's commands. But for our purposes, it highlights the clear link in rabbinic thought between Yechezkel's blood of birth on the one hand and the blood of the Passover sacrifice smeared upon the doorposts and lintels on the other. They are, it seems, one and the same. God's compassionate passing over in Egypt is paralleled in the book of Yechezkel by his passing upon, the abandoned newborn, that is, in order to save it from the certain death that otherwise would have been its unfortunate fate. Of course, to recognize the motif of birth in the events and rituals that lead up to the Exodus, to understand that the moment of redemption constitutes the turning point of Jewish history, is significant in its own right. But the true import of the bold metaphor is actually a function of its larger and later implications. If leaving servitude and embarking on the path of freedom is akin to being born, then experiencing God's ongoing guidance through the wilderness, standing at Sinai to hear his words, journeying to Canaan and settling it, bearing the mandate of ethical monotheism, is the much more involved process leading up to national maturation. There are many worlds of experience that separate the newborn infant from the mature and responsible adult. A myriad of choices and consequences that mark the torturous route from self-absorbed and godless materiality to selfless spiritual enlightenment. And at least in this case, what is true of individuals is true of nations as well. The dynamic progress of the Jewish people towards an apprehension of God and the recognition of their singular mission may have commenced with their first halting steps over that blood-stained threshold, but that was only the beginning of their national story. That story is still being played out even now, more than 3,000 years after the events. May God grant us the wisdom and the understanding to collectively continue along the path of development and progress, culminating in that most coveted of national achievements, ethical refinement and spiritual coming of age. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Hatton. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.